you know that? The culture there is, the ethics behind that are, sit back and be thoughtful with some of our highlighted interviews on Moncrief. Now, when John de Saint-Jour was just 4, his mother disappeared. His father was largely absent, and when he was present, never spoke about her, so much so that John and his brother Maurice didn't even know her name. For a time, they assumed she was dead, but some decades later, John set out to prove that this wasn't true. He's the author of Darling Baby Mine, A Son's Extraordinary Search for His Mother. John, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Now, when you were 4, you were sent to, yourself and your brother were sent to, was it then you were sent to boarding school?
No, for a period, we were in London. My father's a travelling salesman, so he was hardly ever around. But he put us in various homes, mainly with elderly ladies who looked after children. And so from the age of 4 until 7, for about 3 years, that's what we did. And sometimes we were one family, and other times we were with somebody else. And then when I was 7, the bombing had started in London, and a bomb hit a house directly at the end of our garden. And my father decided we should get out of it, you know, take us out to the countryside. And he found a convent school in Hertfordshire, rural Hertfordshire, not that far from London, but safe enough. And he dropped us off there when I was 7 and my brother was 5. And we were there for the next 4 years.
Yeah. And through any of that period, did people ever, somebody must have occasionally asked you about your mother?
Well, it was strange because nobody talked about her. The only incident where she came up in public was about 6 weeks after we'd been at the school. It was a Dominican convent school for 40 boys and 40 girls. And it was run by a South African Mother Superior. But after Mass on Sundays, we gathered in our classrooms, and there, under the supervision of a sister, a teacher, we wrote our letters home. And they taught us to write, and they were Irish nuns, nearly all of them. Mm. And they taught us to write, Dear Mammy and Daddy. Mm. So, you know, being little boys. And by the way, we were physically punished there, and it wasn't a very pleasant place. So we were very much, you know, we obeyed whatever they said. So we wrote that, and we wrote that for about 6 weeks. And then one day, one Sunday, the sister in charge came down to my desk, and she said, "Why are you writing Dear Mammy?" And I said, "Well, you told us to, sister." And she said, are you being insolent?" This is in the book, by the way. Mm. And I said, No, sister, I'm just doing what you told me." And she said, "Well, how old are you?" And I said, 7, sister. And she said, "Well, it's about time you knew that you don't have a mother, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, sister." And she said, I said, "Shall I cross out Mammy?" And she said, "No." She said, she accused me of being insolent, and I declared I wasn't. And then she picked up the letter and tore it into pieces, and she went over to my brother's desk and did the same with him. And from then on, we wrote Dear Daddy, but not Mammy. Now, he'd been receiving these letters. I don't know what he thought, but he must have told the school eventually that, you know, there wasn't a mother. And that's how it happened. That's the only time anybody in authority or in my family mentioned her.
Mm. But you know, in other circumstances, did you come with to an accommodation of just assuming she was dead and telling people so?
Well, we were in a dilemma because, you know, it was only at school, really. When we went to different schools, we eventually left the convent, and my father remarried, and our stepmother was a teacher, and she sent us to state schools. And, you know, the school kids will say, especially in those days, when most people had two parents, and if there was a missing one, it was usually the father because he'd been killed in the war. But, you know, we were odd because we only had a father. And they'd say, "Well, what happened to your mom?" And we didn't know. So we just said, "Well, you know, she died in the war. A lot of people died in the war. So, you know, she could have died." And that was not necessarily true, but it's what we made up.
Mm. Now, when your father remarried and his new wife took on the maternal role, and from what I've read was extremely kind, did she speak about your mother at all?
No, not at all. She took the cue from my father. You know, he didn't talk about her. There were no photographs, no memorabilia in the house, no mention of a name. I didn't know anything about her or her family. And my stepmother, just followed my father, and she didn't mention her, and we didn't mention the mystery to them, because they didn't, in those days, if an adult didn't raise a subject, a child wouldn't question them. And it was a very bizarre situation, but there we were. And my brother and I didn't talk to each other about it. We took our cue silently, I suppose, from our parents. Mm. And we never discussed it, but we came up with the same solution with our friends at school. We just simply said she was dead.
Yeah,
and I didn't know my mother's name until I was 24 years old.
My word. Now, I suppose that's where the crack started to first show, I suppose. You went to Oxford, then you were recruited into MI6, and so you had to be able to provide some information about your mother. Is that when you first learned her name?
That's right. I was 24, and I was just leaving Oxford. And I'd been recruited by MI6, a secret intelligence service. Incidentally, in those days, Britain didn't admit to having a foreign intelligence service at all, although it had two names, and it certainly did exist. So they gave me these vetting forms, and I took them home. And my stepmother, she usually looked after the documents and the paperwork of the family, and I showed things to her, and she gave me my birth certificate, which I'd never seen before, and passport and so on. And then it came to the questions about my biological mother, my real mother. And she said, well, you better talk to your father. So he came into the dining room where I was sitting doing these forms, and he looked like a prisoner about to be interrogated. I mean, he really didn't want to talk about it. But he'd worked for the government in the past, and he knew the importance of these documents, and that he had to come up with, the answers. But he only came up with the answers, the direct answers to the questions. So who was my mother? What's her name? Who were her parents? When was she born? When did they get married? And it turned out then that I learned that they were divorced.
Mm.
I didn't know that before. But I did learn. So, as you say, it was the first crack in the mystery.
Now, you continued on with your career. You left MI6 and you had various other careers. When did you, if you like, actively re-engage with that search for her?
Well, two reasons really behind that. After I left, I was with MI6 in Africa mainly for about 5 years, and then I quit, and I went back to Africa as a freelance journalist, and eventually I became a foreign correspondent on the staff for The Observer. And I was in the Middle East and Africa and other places. But it really wasn't until, my father in the last 5 years of his life had a stroke and wasn't well. I couldn't really ask him. By that time I was ready to ask him, but I couldn't, because I knew he didn't want to talk about it. In fact, he shunned the whole thing as if it never happened, as if he'd never been married to somebody else. And it was when he died, I felt free at last to go after her. And also the other factor was the context, because in the 40s and 50s, Britain and I'm sure Ireland and the States too, they were very closed societies, and there was taboos, social taboos. You didn't talk about this. You didn't do that. You didn't. There were a lot of restrictions, and not just religious ones, but just societal ones. And so, but that changed in the 60s. And everything became much freer, especially in London, where I was living. And I became part of that. That became part of me. And it kind of liberated me, too. And I became a different person and somebody ready to do anything that he wanted for his mother.
Yeah, and was part of that taboo, because as you did go on to discover, a taboo around mental illness?
Yes, it was. That's what I didn't know at the time. But there was a huge stigma about anybody mentally ill. Families. I've had a lot of discussions with people. Actually, a lot of people have contacted me since the book came out, saying they'd had similar experiences. And anything to do with mental health was, something shunted away. Families didn't talk about it, and there were mysteries like mine.
When you found your mother eventually, and she was in a hospital when you found her, how long had she been institutionalized for?
In and out 40 years. She went. What happened was, and I'm pretty sure this is the truth. After the birth of my brother, he was born 16 months after me, 1937. She probably had postpartum depression, which is very common. Mm. And now, of course, it's treated in a very humane and effective way. But in those days, you know, she was erratic. My father was worried about our safety. And sometimes she was with us, sometimes she wasn't. And sometimes she was, you know, lying down and not well. And so, you know, they pack her off. In those days, they'd pack you off to a mental hospital. And the mental hospitals were pretty bad. I mean, they were full of mad and crazy, violent people. And so, you know, she got worse. And then eventually she was diagnosed as a schizophrenic. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But she went through the whole procedures of those days, which were brutal. I mean, she had electric shocks without anesthetics. She had a frontal lobotomy, which, you know, kind of takes away part of your frontal lobes, your brain. And but, you know, somehow she survived. And she had an older sister, which I knew nothing about. I didn't know anything about but my aunt. And she was the only member of her family who stayed with her all those years, in the sense of visiting her. And occasionally she'd come out and go to my aunt's house for a weekend or a week, and then go back in, because by that time, by the time I met her, the hospital was her home.
Yeah. How did that make you? How does that make you feel now about your father? About, you know, he was, I suppose, it was out of an impulse to protect you and your brother.
That's right, and very complex. And one of the reasons I had difficulty writing this memoir, it took a long time, was because there were no, you know, pure villains in it. There were a lot of people who were flawed, and I loved him. You know, he was our protector when we had no protectors and we had no adults around us. And he wasn't around us very much, but whenever he was, it was a ray of sunshine. And so I loved him, and I think he was probably right in taking us away, as people will see in the book. There was an extraordinary exchange of letters that I got hold of between my mother and her best friend just before the break and just after. So there's a lot of evidence there of what happened. Mm-hmm. And she agreed. She agreed that we should be taken away. It was during the beginning of the war, and the Blitz was just about to happen in London, and the bombing had already started. And she was, you know, at her wit's end. She wasn't well, and my father decided to take us away, and she agreed. And also, there was her mother, was my grandmother, was a ferocious woman, possessive woman, who hated my father and wanted to keep us. And so
that probably made it even worse. Yeah, John, we have
to
leave it there, I'm afraid. It's a fascinating story, and thank you so much for speaking with us today. That's John DeSanjor, author of Darling Baby Mine, A Son's Extraordinary Search. More interviews to make you go, on Moncrief, weekdays from 2 p.m.